Hello and welcome to Animal Voices. I'm your host, Steve Romanin. We have a great show lined up for you, an interview with Mark Bekov. It's a rather lengthy one, so we need to get to it right away. Mark Bekov is a professor emeritus of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Colorado Boulder. He's a fellow of the Animal Behavior Society and a former Guggenheim Fellow. In 2000, he was awarded the Exemplar Award for the Animal Behavior Society for major long-term contributions to the field of animal behavior. Mark is also an ambassador for Jane Goodall's Roots and Shoots program, in which he works with students of all ages, senior citizens, and prisoners. He's also a member of the Ethics Committee of the Jane Goodall Institute. He and Jane co-founded the Organization for Ethologists for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, Citizens for Responsible Animal Behavior Studies in 2000. Mark is on the board of directors of the Fauna Society, the Cougar Fund, and on the advisory board for Animal Defenders, the Library Primate Advocacy Group, and Project Coyote. Mark's a busy fellow. A summary of Mark's research on animal emotions titled The Emotional Lives of Animals, A Leading Scientist Explores Animal Joy, Sorrow, and Empathy, and Why They Matter was published in 2007 by New World Library, and his and Jessica Pierce's book on the evolution of moral behavior titled Wild Justice, The Moral Lives of Animals, was published by the University of Chicago Press in 2009. I have this book in my bag, and I'm really looking forward to reading it over my nondescript holiday. Mark's work has been featured on 48 Hours, in Time Magazine, Life Magazine, U.S. News and World Report, The New York Times, New Scientist, BBC Wildlife, Orion, Scientific American, Ranger Rick, National Geographic Kids, on NPR, BBC, Nature Geo, and in a National Geographic Society television special, Play, The Nature of the Game, Discovery TV's Why Dogs Smile and Chimpanzees Cry, and Animal Planet's The Discovery of Play, National Geographic Society's Hunting in America, and more recently in Why We Love Cats and Dogs, and What Animals Think. Mark has also appeared on CNN, Good Morning America, and 2020. Mark makes a lot of appearances, and he's going to be making an appearance on this show in just a few minutes. We don't have any time for news today. I got a song from Kevin Tillman a few minutes before the show started. I guess he sent it late last night, and I want to make sure that we get to it, so I'm not going to read any news today, but I would recommend, I was going to read these pieces, so if you're on the interwebs, go check them out. First of all, from Tree Hugger, 400 baby chicks killed at bankrupt poultry farm, complete with lots of pictures. Might be useful to post on Facebook if you've got some friends who maybe aren't tuned into these issues and don't get a good look at what happens when we treat animals as economic commodities. In the similar vein, Smithfield pig cruelty, leading pork producer caught abusing pigs. This is on Huffington Post, and I would only add to that headline, not surprisingly. And finally, this is an article that, or an issue that I've seen a lot about, maybe only because I live in Canada, but for our listeners that don't, you might want to Google, you can just Google Justin Trudeau and fur, and you'll get a whole bunch of commentaries about a recent Christmas card that he sent out to his potential voters. Like I said, lots of commentary. Not a whole lot of news going on here, but lots of commentary. So I want to head it over to Kevin. If you haven't been listening to the show recently, Kevin Tillman of the Vegan Hip Hop Movement has been sending us songs each and every week for the last, I don't know, about a month and a half already. And he's got a great tune lined up for us today. So I'm going to head over to him. We're going to come back with our interview with Mark Bekov. You are listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. You can check us out on the web at www.animalvoices.ca. On Facebook, we have a brand new page, and I'm making it my New Year's resolution to actually put show updates up there, so you'll be able to find out what's coming up in the coming weeks. You can also email us, of course, at animalvoices@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from our listeners. If you have show ideas, comments, or you just want to say hi. So stay tuned for our interview with Mark Bekov.
It's Kevin from the Vegan Hip Hop Movement with today's soundscape from Soliloquist of Sound. It would be an understatement to call the Soliloquists of Sound a mere hip hop band. Their message and ambitious fusion of varied stylistic genres continue to reinvent the perceptions and experience of music as a whole. Swamberger, Alexandra, Tanya Combs, and Da Vinci are each talented, focused, and motivated enough to hold their own, but they prove to be an undeniably ruthless force when working together. Backed by a powerful message of self-awareness, the soliloquists combine rapid-fire lyricism, jazz-tinged vocals, insightful poetry, and innovative live electronic performance. I've seen the Soliloquists of Sound at least 3 times now, and every time I see them, they give a truly live show. I've been fortunate enough to interview Swamberger about his plant-based diet, which can be seen on the Vegan Hip Hop Movement blogspot. Now here's Our 2 Cents by Soliloquists of Sound from their album As If We Existed.
Based welcome to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. I am your host, Lauren Corman, here with co-host Steve Romanin. Today we're speaking with one of my favorite authors. He's somebody that I've now been teaching at the university level for a couple of years, and we are speaking today with Mark Beckhoff, and I'm delighted to have him here. He's an extremely prolific writer, very well respected. Some of the books that you might know if you've been browsing your animal section of your local bookstore, there's a book called Wild Justice, The Moral Lives of Animals. There's the book called The Animal Manifesto that is also recently out. But it's hard to keep track of Mark because he's always writing so much and doing so much work. He's also involved with the Jane Goodall Roots and Shoots program, among other projects. So Mark, I wanted to welcome you to the show.
Well, it's good to be here. Thanks so much. I hope you're having reasonable weather now.
Yeah, we had a bit of a problem getting this interview started because Steve was on a bus that got hit by a car in the midst of a snowstorm. So we're very pleased that you were able to rejig your schedule and to be here today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Now, I'm going to do kind of an unconventional thing. I should start off not by talking about myself and go right into your work, but I am actually going to speak a little bit about myself. And part of the reason why is because I've been teaching critical animal studies at Brock University now for almost 2 years, and I'm teaching a class called Animals and Cross-Cultural Perspective. And I've always been interested in your work, Mark, but in particular, I got interested as I started thinking about this question of culture, and I started to get really enmeshed in what is sometimes called the animal culture wars, or even the chimpanzee culture wars. The question of animal culture is a very big one. And so I wanted to question what it means to have culture. And this is something that characteristically has been assumed to be a human, simply a human capability.
Right. I mean, it's not my area of expertise, but I do know there's been a lot of work on culture in animal societies recently on tool use in birds. So I think when we use the word culture, at least people in ethology or the study of animal behavior mean, you know, the non-genetic transmission of some skill, meaning that, you know, it's not in the genotype, it's something that's learned and passed down. So there's examples of culture and tool use in chimpanzees. Some populations don't use tools, and those that do often use them in distinct ways. And the same thing has been recently discovered in New Caledonian crows. These are big-brained, smart birds who are able to make and use more complex tools than our chimpanzees. And recently it's been discovered that parent or adult New Caledonian crows actually provide what's called a tool school, where they bring their young to a certain area where they can practice making tools in a very specific way. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you just define culture in that general way, which it usually is, then, you know, there's no doubt that animal societies have culture.
This is the reason why I started getting immersed in your work, because I didn't see you writing a lot about culture per se, but it seems like a parallel set of conversations, because a lot of your work deals specifically with questions around morality and the social lives of animals. You spend a lot of time studying play, and that although this might not necessarily be seen as aspects of culture, it seems to be a related set of conversations about the inner worlds of animals and what science traditionally has allowed animals to be or not to be. And I guess I'll start there. And maybe I'll ask you to define your field. Specifically, I guess you're known primarily as a cognitive ethologist. So tell us a little bit about that and then your particular research interests and how you came to those questions.
Right. Cognitive ethology is basically the study of animal minds. It could be animal emotions, it could be the moral lives of animals, and like you just said, it could be culture. It's, you know, what's going on in between their ears. For years, I've been interested in the evolution of social behavior in canids, which are members of the dog family. So I've studied the long-term field studies of coyotes, I've studied wolves, and a lot of work actually on domestic dogs, the development of behavior, and also play behavior. And I've always been interested in, you know, basically what they know, what they feel, what they believe, and how they use their knowledge, their feelings, in their social interactions, basically. And that led me directly into asking questions about what we call wild justice or the moral lives of animals. So it's all related, but it's all spread out over decades of research and writing.
I was so impressed even by the title, Wild Justice, the Moral Lives of Animals. So think about animals as being moral subjects in the world is so outside of maybe not people's daily lives and what we know of animals, but in terms of the academy and what's permissible sort of questions to ask, to think about the morality of animals. We're still having some debates within in certain aspects of the academy about whether animals are even sentient, whether or not they can feel pleasure and pain, let alone to have these more sort of sophisticated, we might think of sophisticated capabilities as well. And I'm wondering about your position. I know that you've left the academy, but your position within the scientific community, I assume things are starting to change. There's starting to be more research in this area that allows for these kinds of questions to be asked and this research to be done. But I imagine you're still a bit of a heretic, according to some scientists right now.
Yeah, I mean, I felt like I was a heretic, or that, I like to say, you know, the first penguin who steps out onto the thin ice sort of to see whether there are any killer whales or leopard seals around. But the fact of the matter is things have really changed, especially within over the last decade. And so I feel less of a heretic. And to be honest with you, I think it's really hard to find an academic now who would categorically say, well, I'm not sure whether dogs feel joy, or I'm not sure whether elephants feel grief, or chimpanzees feel grief or joy or resentment. It would astound me to actually find a colleague who thought that. How far they're willing to go with it is another question, but things have radically changed, and I like to say that the question now isn't do animals have emotions, but why have they evolved? And I really believe that, you know, a lot of the best research that's being conducted, especially in the field, is really predicated on the fact that animals can think and they can feel, and there are certain rules of social engagement that influence how they interact with one another. A lot of the skeptics haven't ever done field research. They watch a couple of rats or monkeys in a rather impoverished cage, and so they don't even provide the opportunity for the animals to, you know, tell you who they are, basically.
We're going to go to a station ID soon, but I did want to ask you before we go to our station ID about this charge of anthropomorphism, because although the field is changing and people are more open to having these sorts of conversations, and also research in this area is becoming more prolific and more widely accepted, there still is this hovering question of anthropomorphism and this notion that somehow if you're talking about those inner states of animals and their feelings and their emotions, that we should be careful about how we're labeling them and to not project what is assumed to be human-only emotions into what animals are doing, or to interpret it sort of more cautiously than calling it things like morality, for example.
Right, and that's also changed over, I'd say, maybe over the last couple of years. There's a lot less resistance to it, and in my books, across the board, Wild Justice, The Emotional Lives of Animals, The Animal Manifesto, I argue that, you know, we have no other way to describe and explain animal behavior but to use human terms, and that it usually comes down to double talk. So sometimes I'll say to somebody, I'll say, oh, you know, look at that elephant in the zoo, she's not happy. And they'll say, oh, you're wrong. You're being anthropomorphic. She's happy. And then it gets really quiet. And the reason it gets quiet is because it's anthropomorphic to say that an animal's happy. And if you will, you know, if you really want to buy into the notion of anthropomorphism, it's anthropomorphic to say that they're not happy. So it's pretty much double talk. I actually don't worry. I don't even think about it anymore. And once again, I see that, you know, serious scholars don't really invoke that. Serious scholars, once again, will say, well, yeah, it's clear that chimpanzees or elephants grieve, or that dogs feel joy when they're playing. Let's understand what's going on in their heads, what's going on in their hearts, and why would a particular emotion evolve? And so there's been no resistance using, if you will, the sort of analog of anthropomorphism in physiology and anatomy, you know, using Darwin's ideas about evolutionary continuity. So if there's continuity in physical, physiology and anatomy, there's also continuity in behavior and mental state. So, you know, we don't say animals have a, quote, stomach or a, quote, heart. You know, like some people will say, well, dogs are, quote, happy, or chimpanzees, quote, grieve. But we can get rid of the quotes. And that's, and I think to me, that's where the most exciting research is going on now. People are getting rid of, I mean, they're just getting away from this kind of academic type of thing, you know, where they don't understand something, so they'll spend the rest of their lives arguing that it doesn't exist rather than accepting that it exists and then using good evolutionary theory, you know, or good biology, if you will, to understand it.
Why do you think there is a shift now, or over the past decade? What has changed? Just more people in the field doing this kind of work?
I think it's a combination of more people doing the work and more people really paying attention to who the animals are, what they can do, that we, you know, all mammals share the same parts of the brain and the limbic system that are important in the expression and the feeling of emotions, for example. And I think just people are getting beyond themselves, you know, thinking that we're unique and special. I mean, we are unique and we are special, but so too are dogs and mice and whales and chimpanzees. So, you know, it's kind of blurring that boundary, if you will, and accepting that there's a lot of similarities and there's a lot of differences, and we should really respect the similarities and the differences. So I think part of it is the amount of research and the arguments have just changed, and people are realizing that to say that there's this split between human and other animals in the cognitive, emotional, or moral arena, it just doesn't work anymore. I mean, that's basically the way I look at it.
I think that's a good place to take a station ID. We've done a little bit of sort of the theoretical framing, the historical piece, and how you're situated in the midst of these conversations. And I really want to come back and hear some stories and specifics about some of your observations and that practice of paying attention that you've done and what that has elicited from your observations. So we'll come back with Mark Beckhoff on Animal Voices. Please stay tuned. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Lauren Corman, here with Steve Romanin, doing all the technical wizardry for us today. We are joined by Mark Beckhoff, a very esteemed cognitive ethologist. He's somebody who's interested in the stuff that happens between animals' ears, animal minds, animal behaviors, and all the internal states and their subjective experiences. I'm quite delighted that he's here. Before the break, we were talking a little bit about the change in the field of cognitive ethology and that kind of interdisciplinary set of sciences that he's been involved with over the past, well, more than a decade now. And I wanted to get into some of the observations that you and your colleagues in this set of related fields have made over the years. It's a chance for you to tell some stories, and they're not just sort of just happy, interesting animal stories, but to really, they also have moral implications as well. And so I'd like it if you could maybe pull out some of the things that you've observed about morality or play, some of those topics that have been close to your heart for a while now.
Sure. Number of really good stories. When I was in northern Kenya in the Samburu National Reserve, I was watching elephants with Ian Douglas Hamilton, who's a very famous elephant behaviorist, if you will. And I saw a female elephant named Babel who had an injured rear foot. And she just walked slower than, an ant, if you will. And I noticed that the other elephants in the group were waiting for her and that the matriarch even fed her. And so it was just really interesting. I asked Ian what was going on, and Ian said, well, you know, she's been injured for a really long time. I don't think that they know why, but at least for 15 years, you know, basically the elephants in her group have been waiting for her and some have fed her. And when I published that observation, you know, some of my colleagues said, well, surely she's doing something for them, you know, because you don't want to really think that animals are showing compassion or empathy. And the fact of the matter is that Babel could do nothing for them. She could hardly walk, and had she been left alone, you know, she would have been taken down by a predator. So it was just really great, you know, to see this kind of concern and compassion for an injured animal. So that was one story. I've got a bunch. Another was I was riding my bicycle with my friend Rod back into Boulder, and we came around a corner, and we saw a dead magpie in the road. And around the magpie were four other magpies, and I stopped because it was so clear they were doing something that was really special. One magpie went in and pecked at the corpse. Another did the same. Then one flew off and brought back some pine needles and some twigs and laid it right on the corpse. Another did the same. Another did the same. And then the four magpies stood around the corpse and bowed their heads and their beaks and flew off. And, I mean, I was sitting there, like, incredulous. And Rod, my friend, who knew nothing about behavior, said, "My God, did you see that? You probably know about that. You've seen that before." And I went, "No, I've never seen it." And so I published that observation, and to date I've had 70 or so emails of people seeing the same sort of funeral ritual, if you will, in magpies, crows, and ravens, the corvids, who are usually thought to be the big-brained smart birds. And then a couple of months ago I had a woman email me from England, and she'd seen the same sort of ritual in a sparrow. And so, you know, those two stories just really have touched me, and they're always worth repeating because they really show an expression of very deep felt emotions. And I suppose some skeptics might boil it down to try to boil those observations down to something that would be reflexive or not, doesn't entail any kind of feeling on the animals, but it's impossible to do so really with any meaning.
Mm. The sort of skeptic view, I guess, in its most extreme form, is that animals are these stimulus response machines.
Right, right. The skeptic view would be they've been conditioned or they've learned something, you know, because they've been reinforced in a certain way. But once again, you know, that view is really changing as we begin to watch wild animals. And like I said before, I think it's really important that we have to recognize the fact that a lot of the fascinating things that that animals do don't happen a lot. I mean, they happen, you know, enough. And so you've got to be lucky enough to be there to see them. But you're not going to see these sorts of things in some kind of cage where you have, you know, four animals and no stimuli, for example.
Well, this, I think, is part of the concern about some of the work in cognitive ethology, that people will say, well, if we're going to pay attention to continuity and similarity, the best way to do that, because of our particular fetishization of science in particular ways where we think that lab research is the best research, that people are concerned sometimes. I know that there's been people within the field of animal law that have made the argument that if we talk about similarities, this is actually going to promote animal research where we're doing lab experiments.
Right, but you have to realize that there are also differences, but you get into a double bind. Animals are similar enough to us to use in research, then they're also similar to us in terms of being sentient and feeling pain. So how do you justify it? I mean, it's just illogical, and it's bad biology to argue that they're similar enough to us physiologically and anatomically, but not, say, behaviorally or emotionally.
Hmm.
It's playing the middle for both ends, and you just can't do that. And so that's why I think things are changing. There's been some excellent research showing, for example, you know, that rats like to be tickled, and they actually laugh. They feel joy. And although the research is horrifically invasive, and, you know, you have to kill the rats, you know, they can say, well, we're doing euthanasia and blah, 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 but you're killing the rats. So what's come out of that has been very clear evidence that rats experience joy. And there's also been horrific experiments showing that mice display empathy, that they feel the pain of other mice. And so I just think, once again, you know, it's just very important to realize that these animals have amazing cognitive, emotional, and moral capacities, and we're just starting to tap into them. So people have to be patient. This research is a couple of decades old. It's not, you know, centuries old like other types of scientific research. So we just have to be patient, and I think the patience is paying off.
Well, what do you do then as a scientist when you're looking at those sorts of studies that are coming out that, as you said, things are starting to change and we're starting to recognize that, you know, for example, rats like to be tickled, but it's tied to this invasive research. Well, how do you sort of make sense of that, or what do you do as somebody who's publishing in the area when are you drawing on that kind of research that really seems to be antithetical to what morally and ethically your project has been about? In addition to, of course, observing animals and paying close attention, you're also making moral arguments about the implications of these sorts of capacities for animals as well.
Absolutely, and that's a great question. I mean, I do use that research, and I also argue that we don't need to do any more of it. I think that it's paying respect to the animals to use that research and to then argue we don't need to do it again. I mean, the problem is you can't undo the pain that was caused to the mice. You can't undo the killing of the rats. But now that we have conclusive evidence from really good scientific research, we don't have to do any more of it. And that's exactly how I feel. I think that if the data are there, we should use it, but we don't have to do any more. And you can use that information. It's almost out of respect for the animals who were used in the research to use that information so that no other animals are used in that sort of research.
You've talked a little bit about grieving and about empathy. And I know that another major area for your research has been around play. Could you tell us about that and about some of the stories that stand out for you regarding play or your observations?
I always tell people if they want to know about my research, I wrote a kid's book 2 years ago that I summarize about 30 years of research in 28 pages. But play is really interesting to study because when animals play, they use actions from different contexts like predatory behavior or sexual behavior or aggressive behavior. You know, they bite one another and shake their heads from side to side. They slam into one another. They'll often mount one another. And so somehow the animals have to, you know, a player, you know, say you have Fido and Pluto, the dogs, you know, they have to convince one another that they're playing and not trying to mate or dominate one another or eat one another. And so what's interesting about play is that certain behavior patterns have evolved that we call play signals or play markers. The one I've studied a lot is called the play bow. It's when a dog or a wolf or a coyote or a fox bows on their forelimbs, they crouch and they put their hind end up in the air, and sometimes they wag their tail and sometimes they bark. And that's a signal that says, come play with me. And it's a very ritualized, clear signal. It's unambiguous. It sends the message, I want to play with you. And so we studied that, and we discovered that, you know, it's used a lot to initiate play, as we assumed, and it's also used almost exclusively in play. You'll see it in other contexts, but it's usually in play. But then what we discovered that was fascinating, and this really has a lot to say about morality, fairness, cooperation, wild justice, if you will, is that in wolves and dogs and coyotes, they also use the play bow before they launch on other animals and bite them really hard. So right before they do that, they use the play bow as if to say, I'm going to bite you really hard, but this is in play. And they also use the bow right after an action like biting and shaking the head from side to side, as if to say, you know, I'm sorry I bit you, I apologize, forgive me, let's play. And we've done years of research to show that, you know, statistically, animals use the play bow very strategically to basically send the messages, I want to play with you, or I apologize, you know, I didn't mean to bite you so hard, let's keep playing. The play bow brings back the play mood.
And why is play important to animals?
Well, there's lots of theories, and not one theory explains it all, but there's a number of theories. One is that play is important in social development and socialization, and I think that that's pretty clear that it it does work that way. So it allows animals to develop social skills and learn how to communicate with one another. Another is that it's important in physical development. What's called the training response plays important in both aerobic and anaerobic exercise. And the training response would be the development of strength in tendons, bones, and muscles, for example. The other theory is it's important in cognitive development. I always, you know, you could call it eye-hand coordination or eye-paw coordination. Mm-hmm. You know, animals learn how hard they can hit one another or bite one another or how high a cliff they can jump off. But a couple of years ago, I published a paper with two colleagues, and we proposed that the one function of play that seems to cross species and perhaps is evolutionarily the oldest function of play is what we call training for the unexpected. And that came from observations that play sequences are incredibly unpredictable, and it's like the animals are practicing combining different actions, and they're not sure what to expect, but they know it's play, and that trains them to deal with unpredictable environments, unpredictable social environments, changes in group structure, or unpredictable physical environments, changes in food availability, changes in habitat, changes in prey base, for example. Hmm. And we're excited about that because people are finding that that might be one of the ancestral functions of play. The important thing is that there's not one function that fits all species, but there's no doubt that play plays some role in social development, physical development, and cognitive development.
Hmm. And is this, in your view, I mean, it's not just knowledge for knowledge's sake, although that's important and paying attention is important, but the kinds of arguments and observations that you make, you do in your work tend to tie them to the ethical implications. Can you say more about that?
Well, yeah. I mean, this is interesting. You know, it depends how you want to define ethics. I do, and I have for decades, tied my research into the ethics of how animals are treated and how they shouldn't be treated. We've also tied the play research into discussions of wild justice, ethics, or morality, in that the animals really are playing by specified rules of engagement. If they don't play fairly, then they can be ostracized from their group. Other animals won't play with them. So there's a social consequence to not playing fairly, and we're seeing the same thing in play in schoolyards among, you know, young human children. So we have used the play data to develop an argument that animals have moral sensibility or moral intelligence, and that they know right from wrong, and there's certain things that they can't do, and if they do them and they do them enough, then there will be a consequence, just as there is in humans.
Mm.
You know, humans do not like being treated unfairly, and nor do non-human animals. And once again, you know, it's good biology that leads to that sort of conclusion.
Mm. One of the things that irritates me sometimes is that when people are studying animals, that sometimes, because we tend to be very anthropocentric, people will think less about the animals and then say, well, what does it really mean, though, for us? Like, animals become models that we use to make sense of human behavior. And I think that there's some validity in that. I'm not throwing that out entirely, but it becomes a kind of an erasure of difference and a kind of appreciation for all of the amazing things that animals do on their own terms. And so it seems like in your position that you're kind of walking a fine line, because there's an appreciation for who the animals are, but it's also, I guess to some degree, you are saying that this information can be helpful for making sense of and situating ourselves in terms of our own natural relationships with each other and social relationships with each other, is that animals can tell us something about how we relate or could relate to each other as well.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, there's such a change now from that survival of the fittest, nature red in tooth and claw, that animals are, and humans too, human animals, are much more cooperative and fair than theory has suggested. I mean, that's across the board. People studying behavioral economics, resource distribution and sharing are finding across cultures that people are much fairer. There's a wonderful book by a psychologist named Daka Keltner at the University of California in Berkeley called Born to Be Good. And in fact, the bottom line, or one of the couple of bottom lines to my new book, The Animal Manifesto, deals with the notion of the compassion footprint. The subtitle for The Animal Manifesto is 6 Reasons for Expanding Our Compassion Footprint. And I've played off of Daka's work there and shown that new data, I mean data that are coming in all the time, show that among most primates, more than 90% of their interactions are what we call cooperative or pro-social, meaning positively social, that fighting and real harmful fighting is extremely rare. So that's another paradigm shift that people are realizing, that, you know, it's not nature red in tooth and claw. So sure, animals fight with one another and compete with one another, but compared to their more positive interactions, it's actually very rare. And once again, you know, if you think about the natural history of animals and animals in the wild, it's really dangerous to fight, even if you're a really dominant, say, chimpanzee or a dominant gorilla or a dominant wolf. You can get hurt beating up a subordinate animal. And so you may beat them up, but if you get hurt, then there can be really deleterious effects on your reproductive fitness and your future. Mm. So I'm really excited about that the research on play is showing that there's a lot more goodness and fairness and equity and cooperation and a sense of justice, if you will, in non-human animals.
You talked a lot about evolution, and I'm wondering if that's, I guess that's a main framework that you use to make sense of why animals are behaving the way that they're behaving. And I know that in the social sciences, when we look at human beings, if we tie human behavior strictly to evolution, that people will say that's sociobiology and it erases things like free will and human agency and all those sorts of things. And I'm wondering how we make sense of, if we're going to open ourselves to animals and their great richness, how do you make sense of their behavior? Is it strictly evolutionary? Do you mean that in a different way than maybe is interpreted in terms of just strictly genetic propagation of the species?
I mean it in a thoroughly different way. Oh, yeah. I don't even think about evolution and determinism and genetics that way. When I say evolution, I'm asking questions of why would a particular behavior or behavioral phenotype evolve? What selective forces? So it involves amazing contributions of the immediate environment, not only the genetics. And so, you know, I don't think of it as instinct. I don't think of it as being hardwired. It just means, you know, why would you expect cooperation to evolve? Why would you expect empathy to evolve? The view of evolution as meaning totally genetic, lack of free will, and stuff like that is a very naive view of evolution. I mean, Charles Darwin never meant that. And sure, you know, you've got schools of sociobiology that look at a lot of sort of predetermined behavior, if you will, deterministic types of views. But that's really not what people mean. That what they really mean is, you know, why would it evolve that, you know, elephants should show empathy to, you know, an injured friend? Why would grief evolve? Why would joy evolve? And then it can explain it in lots of different ways. And then how do animals learn to express those emotions? So one of the real hot areas now in evolutionary biology is the evolution of flexibility, the evolution of the ability for animals to show variable behavior depending on changes in the social and non-social or physical environment.
Mm.
Yeah, so no, it's a really completely different set of questions. There's a lot of naivety out there among some people who talk about the evolution of behavior. Evolutionary psychologists have often been accused of jamming everything into some kind of instinct mode or reproductive fitness mode. Everything you or I do is motivated by reproduction. That's just not really the way to look at it.
I know that you've spent a lot of time looking at animals that live on land, but you've also spent time looking at aquatic animals. And I think for all of the tremendous progress that has happened in terms of a willingness for people to engage with cognitive pathology, that you're not seen as a heretic anymore, that animals in water, animals in the oceans, this is still something, I think that for people, it becomes even more foreign, potentially. It becomes a little bit more difficult sometimes to get people to connect or to open themselves up. Maybe you haven't sensed that, but this is what I've noticed with students, that something about the ocean, it just seems so strange, another world, or sets of worlds, really. And I was wondering if you could talk specifically about animals and water.
Yeah, no, you're bringing up a really great point. You know, we talk about what's happening beneath the surface, you know, what you don't see. It's almost analogous to what happens behind closed laboratory doors or behind the doors of these, you know, horrendous slaughterhouses. What you don't see, you don't really think about. But there's phenomenal work on the social behavior and cognitive and emotional capacities of dolphins and whales, for example. And there's lots of research being done on that right now. It's difficult to do under the water, but humans are pretty smart. We can learn to, you know, overcome those limitations. But, you know, there's lots of research now on empathy in dolphins, compassion, caregiving, play.
Can you give us some examples?
Oh, yeah. You know, play, for example, people are studying that. It's harder to do. But, you know, seeing once again that there are very specific patterns of play solicitation and very specific rules of engagement, the violation of which, you know, really results in the lack of play and animals maybe being rejected from their group. Dolphins taking care of injured dolphins, for example, trying to raise them to the surface. So once again, because of the technical difficulties, it's just going to take time, but it's happening. I mean, the same with birds. You know, who would have ever thought that New Caledonian crows could manufacture and use more complex tools than chimpanzees? You know, whoever thought that mice could feel the pain of other mice? So, once again, it's just a matter of having patience and giving people the time to do the research and seeing what they find, rather than just saying, you know, it just can't be the case.
I love your word patience, because this is something that you brought up at the beginning of the interview as well. And I think that from an animal rights, an animal welfare, an animal liberationist perspective, an activist in the field that's looking at just egregious forms of animal suffering, that it's so tough sometimes, a lot of the time, to be patient and to have these ideas percolate and to get people to change their behavior, or to really to ask some serious questions and to do some serious lobbying against these industries that are completely denying and just reducing animals to this sort of machine image that is so outdated. And I'm wondering how you respond to the activist that doesn't want to be so patient because things are really just so bad for animals.
I think that's a really great example, Lauren. I don't think we need to be all that patient anymore with animal abuse. We know enough to stop most of all abuse, but we know enough now to really have much greater restrictions on animal experimentation, animals as entertainment in rodeos and zoos and circuses, animals in education. So I have to be honest to say that I don't think we need to be patient at all. We have enough information. We had enough information 40 and 50 years ago to know that animals suffer in certain situations. The patience, I mean, is let's let the field of cognitive ethology, animal cognition, develop and give us patience to collect the data to, like I said before, to see who the animals are. And what I mean that is, in lots of cases, they're more than we give them credit for, and in some cases, maybe they don't do the things that we think that they should or could do. But once again, we just need to have the patience to collect the data and see who the animals are.
Mm. It seems that one of the main arguments, though, around similarity is that because it's been used in ethical arguments by animal activists, there's this notion that we should care about these group of animals, such as the Great Ape Project makes that sort of argument. We should care about the great apes because they're so similar to us, and they'll point to various different studies in cognitive pathology to make their arguments. And of course, then the bar is often changing, and our definitions about what is similar enough to us gets more and more restrictive, and it's very frustrating. So I understand you're sort of partitioning pointing them out a little bit to say there's animal activists here, we have enough information, we can go forward, we can move ahead. But that cognitive ethology work is being mobilized by activists because they're still playing that similarity game to try to get people to change their behavior towards animals, because that has some cultural currency to say, hey, look, they're like us, therefore we shouldn't treat them this way.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think that, you know, the similarity argument is an important one to invoke in, you know, how the animals are used. But like I said before, it's also fascinating to look at the differences. You know, why are wolves different from coyotes? You know, chimpanzees are our closest relatives. The males are hardly the model we would want to use for paternal behavior. Chimpanzees, fathers aren't good fathers. But what I'm saying is that in terms of the cognitive and certainly the emotional capacities, there's a ton of similarities. I mean, there's just no doubt about that. And that's what causes the problem. If they're similar enough to us, if you will, to use in certain sorts of research, then we have to take into account how that similarity would argue against their use. And that's what's very difficult for some people. It's not particularly difficult for me, to be honest with you. I just think that we shouldn't be doing research on chimpanzees. It's just as simple as that. I mean, I could list other animals, but I'm just saying that if you want a place to start, you know, we shouldn't be doing that. We know mice show empathy. We know they feel pain. But yet in the United States, we've known that for 6 years. It hasn't even figured remotely into a revision of the Animal Welfare Act, which I think is an egregious oversight by scientists that, you know, 99% of the animals used in the United States, in fact, are not protected by the Animal Welfare Act, but yet people who are behind the act or revise the act congratulate themselves, you know, for having, quote, very good severe restrictions. The Animal Welfare Act does very little, in all honesty.
Do you see your work as being activist-oriented or activism in
itself? Absolutely. Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, I think that it's, you know, it depends how you define activism, but I do lead protests and I have led protests. And as you know, a lot of my writing is very heavily based in getting people out there to do things and take responsibility for their acts and to basically show and demonstrate that cruelty can't stand the spotlight. And there's enormous cruelty in scientific research. And so, yes, I'm an activist and I'm a proud activist. I think it's incumbent on scientists and academics to get off their butts and take a position on things. I was just in Australia 2 weeks ago, and so in Australia, kangaroos are just being killed left and right. And the scientists I know who are trying to stop that are being told by other scientists that science is objective and that they can't be advocates, but it's these very people who are supporting the killing industry. So they're hardly not being activists and advocates. It's just they're being activists and advocates for the killing of the kangaroos, not the saving of them. So it's double talk, because they're not being any more objective, if you will, than the scientists and the researchers who are arguing that we shouldn't be killing the kangaroos. It's like the anthropomorphism thing, you know. It's like, I can't say that a lone elephant in a zoo in Alaska isn't miserable. Well, of course she's miserable. And when they say, no, she's happy, they're being anthropomorphic. So you just can't play that game anymore. And I think what's wonderful about the field of cognitive ethology and animal studies, like the work that you're doing and bringing in lots of different disciplines, is we're all converging on the fact that animals are amazing beings. We should let them tell us who they are, and we should use that information to enrich their lives and make their lives better.
We could almost end it there, but I know we have 2 more minutes left, and I did want to just let you say what you wanted to say outside of a question, if there's any last words or a book that you wanted to promote or a story that you wanted to tell, to turn it over to you, Mark.
Right. Well, thank you. I appreciate your interview. No, I think I would repeat that animals are more than we give them credit for. In my book, The Animal Manifesto, I basically argue that animals are saying, you know, treat us better or let us alone. Because all animals except our companion animals could do quite well without us. And I would also have to say that I'm an optimist, I'm a dreamer, people who know me know that, and that there's a lot of goodness out there, and we shouldn't have the energy sucked out of us by negativity. We need all the positive energy that we possibly can have to basically make the world better for animals. And by making the world better for animals, we're also making the world better for humans. You know, I'm very interested in human well-being as well. So putting a lot of attention into animals doesn't mean putting less attention into humans. And we need to serve as models for children because they're the ambassadors for the future. So I'm positive. I know there's so much negativity and negative things going on, but if we let that suck us down, then we're screwed. So that's what I would say.
Mark, thank you so much. And I really want to commend you for your work. It's been, I love the books, and it's a real joy to teach your work. And I commend you for writing about science in a way that's really accessible. So I appreciate that.
Well, thank you. And thank your audience for listening. And I hope you all have happy holidays.
Thanks, Mark. I wanted to plug a couple of his books. Mark mentioned The Animal Manifesto. One of the other books that we were talking about today is called Wild Justice, The Moral Lives of Animals. Another book that I'd like to recommend from 2007, so a little bit older now, is called The Emotional Lives of Animals. A Leading Scientist Explores Animal Joy, Sorrow, and Empathy and Why They Matter. But he's got lots of other books as well on a very developed website. You can Google him there too. So thanks very much, Mark.
Hey, thank you. Have a good holiday.
Thanks, you too. Bye.
Bye-bye.
That's all for Animal Voices today. Join us next week, same time. And join us on our website, animalvoices.ca, on Facebook, on our brand new page, and email us at animalvoices@gmail.com. Stay tuned for Raw Sugar with Charissa.